Don't you remember, don't you know, Daddy worked a man called Cotton Eye Joe. Daddy worked a man called Cotton Eye Joe. Fiddle and rosin your bow, play a little tune called Cotton Eye Joe, play a little tune called Cotton Eye Joe. Where do you come from? Where do you go? Where do you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? Where do you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? Come for to sing, come for to show you my diamond ring, come for to show you my diamond ring. I fell down, stubbed my toe, call for the doctor, Cotton Eye Joe, call for the doctor, Cotton Eye Joe. Rosin my bow, gonna make music everywhere I go, gonna play a tune called Cotton Eye Joe. Tune my fiddle and rosin my bow, gonna make music everywhere I go, gonna play a tune called Cotton Eye Joe.
That was a song called Cotton Eye Joe from a wonderful CD that I've just gotten my hands here today called Banjo Diary, Lessons from Tradition. It's on the Smithsonian Folkways label, and it's features Stephen Wade as banjoist and singer, and he also has a lot of other people joining him on this CD, which has a lot of traditional tunes that he has picked up from over the years of his long career, as he would say, probably nearly all of his life, yep. Working in the business of folk music and folk music research and field research, and it's actually in the area of field research that he's here in our community today, meaning specifically Urbana. This show is live and local, by the way. I'm Kevin Kelly. Thanks very much for joining us, and Stephen Wade's going to be my guest for this hour. He has a book that's called The Beautiful Music All Around Us, subtitle, Field Recordings and the American Experience, which is in turn an offshoot of a larger project that he got involved with for Rounder Records called A Treasury of Library of Congress Field Recordings, which consist of recordings made by other people back in the 30s and 40s and so on, in the field, meaning not necessarily out in a field, but it could have been, of people singing different types of songs in their element, meaning in their home, in their church, in their community, to get an idea of what folk music sounded like off of, let's say, a commercial record or off of out of the concert scene and so on. And this book just came out last fall. At the same time, actually, came out the CD that you just heard a sample of, Banjo Diary. And Stephen is going to be giving a couple of events this weekend in Urbana, tomorrow from 12 to 4 at the Community Center for the Arts in downtown Urbana. He'll be giving for 4 hours, it's going to be a pretty extensive banjo workshop. I can imagine him getting kind of tired. And then on Sunday, he'll be given a house concert at the home of Danny Otto and Barbara Schenck. That starts at 4 o'clock. And that's going to be kind of a multimedia presentation, at least as I understand it.
We'll let him
elaborate. So Stephen Wade is with us. He's brought a couple of banjos along, and we have the CD you just heard, and we also have the companion CD to the beautiful music all around us. Stephen, thank you, Kevin. Coming back on the show, actually.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized it was 3.5 years ago that you were here to talk about a fellow named Archie Green, who I guess was a labor organizer and became a folklorist.
Professor here, he was a brilliant man and a great thinker. I wouldn't have had this book. This is published by University of Illinois Press. And in 1972, he came up with a title for a series and did the first book in that series called Music in American Life. And his book in 1972, Only a Minor, is just a classic book. And he encouraged me so much to write this book. And I had this wonderful tradition of this series and the people at the press, and they're great. Staff and editors, Judy McCullough and Lori Matheson and the other folks who work there. And I spent 18 years on this book. The project itself started when I did that in 1994 when I began to put together an album, the one that you mentioned, a Treasury of Library of Congress field recordings, that had 30 songs on it. But that was in June 94. By a couple months later, we all knew I was writing a book. And it was just going to have to be a book. And I visited all 30 places where those recordings, after I'd picked them, had taken place and sought out the families in those communities. And eventually, 12 of those stories really become this 504-page book that weighs 3 pounds that you've got in your
hand. I was going to say, this is a very heavy book.
Yeah.
It's a nice, heavy, glossy paper with lots of photos.
And 50 pictures.
And so on. The you raised some issues in the preface to the book, and actually I love the way you make this a preface to this whole business of field recording and talking to discovering people in their element. You use the example of a fellow in Chicago. What was he called? Casey Jones, who the Chicken Man or something like that.
Yeah, he was amazing. His real name was born name was Anderson Punch, and he was born 1870 in Marshall, Texas. Came up to Chicago in 1912, and when I was just 8 or 9 years old, I first saw him on the streets of Chicago where I had grown up, and he had a sign around his neck saying he had trained 217 chickens in Chicago, and they were all named Mae West.
And they all died of natural causes.
That's right.
He said.
That's what he said. And he was a street performer, and he had a button accordion, and he did this thing, interactions with May, where he'd give her some corn, and she'd move towards him, and he'd dance with her, and he had a little flask, and she'd drink something from it and wobble, and then he'd do the shimmy, she wobble, and he'd have his hand, no dime, no show. And he was just this ceaseless stream of colloquial speech and the squeeze box accordion melodies of another day. And it was fascinating. I mean, I looked up his arrest record. He was constantly getting hauled in for obstructing traffic, but it wasn't him. He wasn't one obstructing traffic. It was the crowds around him. He demonstrated. I mean, I didn't know the words to say it then, but he demonstrated art was wherever you find it. And he had turned a street corner into a theatrical milieu. And it was extraordinary. And I saw him a bunch of times as a kid. I guess that was my first, totally imprinted contact with vernacular culture. I really saw it in action, and it meant so much. And by the time I was 10 or 11, I was playing the electric guitar, and my guitar teacher was Jim Schwab of the Siegel Schwab Blues Band. They were 2 years ahead before they had even recorded at that point. And seeing Jim and Corky and their band opening for some of the great Mississippi acts that come up also in the Great Migration, as did Casey. And they'd sometimes have a matinee at these taverns where I saw, Muddy Waters play and Howlin' Wolf, and they have the door open. I could stand outside and listen. And it was this three-dimensional art was wherever you find it. The audience was as fascinating to me as the music, because everybody, there was a shared understanding of what was going on there. I mean, I had very little idea of what a hoochie coochie meant. I had an idea of what a hoochie coochie, but I wasn't quite clear on it at that point. And But they knew, and I could see that there was this understanding. And it was, the environment was hitting me. So by the time I started listening to these Library of Congress records, when I was a teenager, my banjo teacher, Fleming Brown, said, you need to listen to those records. They were audible equivalents of those three-dimensional experiences, because these were recorded, as you said, field records. They're recorded in people's homes and in prisons and where they lived, so the sounds of life were not scrubbed from them. So you could hear roosters crowing and clocks, kitchen clocks ticking, and the truck drives by, and sometimes a neighbor is talking in the background while someone is fiddling. And so there was this presence of life, oh, it's this foreground in music, this background in life. And I found that very appealing, and it came as an utter surprise to me. But when I was listening to those records on carbon microphones available only on, you know, at the Chicago Public Library, at least I didn't know where to buy them, and listening to them there, memories of Casey flooded into my head, and memories of those times as a kid playing the electric guitar and watching Muddy Waters play came in my head while I was hearing those recordings, and I realized these were all connected, interconnected experiences in music and in its situation in life.
Well, you referred to the notion of vernacular folklore or vernacular music, you know, music that is found in the context of life, as opposed to music that is created for the sake of art, I guess.
Well, actually, some of these are. I mean, that tune "Glory in the Meeting House" that's on the CD, and it's chapter 10 in the book. That's a marvelous piece of music. Maybe you should put that on, "Glory in the Meeting House." I just talked to that man's granddaughter earlier today, because I'm going to be back in their community next month, bringing this book back home to them, which is. This tune was never for dancing. This was a concertizing tune. No, it doesn't take place in the concert hall, and it wasn't recorded in one. He'd been in jail the night before. He was bailed out. He'd been in a drunk tank. The guy who was recorded there in 1937. But this is a marvelous piece of art. And his son told me, Jim Strong, Luther Strong's son, told me, you get twisted all out of shape if you tried to dance to this thing. You really ought to put it on, Kevin. Well, it's awful good.
We're gonna be communicating with Mike Pritchard, our sound engineer, because he's got the CDs, and I told him we're probably going to change whatever I might tell you in advance, we're probably going to change it, which we're doing right now. So, Mike, this is on the second CD I gave you. It's track 11.
Yep.
And this is going to be "Glory in the Meeting House." So this is, and he plays it on a fiddle.
Yeah, it's a solo fiddle, and he was doing it in the presence of his teacher. This was in a hotel room in Hazard, Kentucky, and he, like I said, it was on a borrowed fiddle. And he did this and several, it was just a virtuoso survey of Southern fiddling. He was from Eastern Kentucky. And this is one of the many tunes he played. And this is just, well.
Is it originally a fiddle tune, or was it originally a song?
No, it wasn't a song. It was a fiddle tune. It was art for art's sake, this one. I found documentation of this played a fiddle contest in a very early part of the 20th century in Berea, Kentucky. And it was around, and it has probably, you know, old world antecedents, British antecedents, but it continues to ray out. There are other fiddle tunes that are on this same prototype. "Say, Old Man, Can You Play a Fiddle?" and some other tunes like that that have gone on that are related to this particular musical idea that he embodies in this performance.
Let's give a listen. It's Luther Strong, "The Glory in." Glory in the Meeting House.
Glory in the Meeting House.
And this has come off of the companion CD in Stephen Wade's still pretty new book, "The Beautiful Music All Around Us," here on Live and Local. Thank you.
$500 on that.
Right at the end, that's one time we get to hear Luther's voice. He says, I won $500 in that tune. Not at one time, but his accumulated winnings in contests with that tune. So it was he was sort of a champion with that tune. That was a beautiful piece of art there that he knew what it was.
Luther Strong, Glory in the Meeting House, it was recorded in Hazard, Kentucky, in October 1937. And yeah. Stephen Wade included that in his... initially in a larger collection of field recordings for Rounder Records, and it's a subset of those are included with his new book called The Beautiful Music All Around Us from University of Illinois Press. The whole business of field recording, I actually cannot remember when I first heard of a guy named John Lomax mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that he pioneered the business of field recording, or did he just make it famous for Smithsonian?
Well, he wasn't with Smithsonian, and no, he didn't start field recording. But he and his son Alan, they certainly are prominently well known, maybe the best known here among certain field recordists.
And here, meaning in the United States.
Yes. Yeah. Bartok did some of that stuff too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He did. He and Zoltan Kodály would go out and record. So the whole business of field recording, I mean, when I heard about it the first time, I kind of was marveling at the notion that people would run around with a microphone or whatever and stick it in the faces of people who are largely unsuspecting.
Well, I mean, it's coming out of the world of ethnography than the world of commerce, and that's the difference, I guess. And so the people in my book, these people who were recorded by the library, many of them, all the people I write about were not professional musicians. They were domestics, and they were coal miners, and they were people living in cabins who were mothers who had put their brood to sleep with these songs, and there were cowboys and all kinds of people following all kinds of occupations. And these recordings were, in the case of the ones I write, mostly just a day in their life. It was just come and gone, and memory in those families had in many cases did not go on about this. They had no knowledge of these recordings, and yet some of these recordings actually have. Not only has the music continued to renew, but some of these particular performances have had larger significance over our throughout American music.
Well, maybe we can hear, a couple more examples of both of those types. An example maybe of the sort of person who, was literally, I guess, pulled out of a schoolhouse?
Yes. You're thinking, well, there's a couple school children that are in the book and on the CD with the book, and that's Oradell Graham. I think you mentioned you were interested. Oradell was 12 years old, and she was recorded at school. She recorded three songs that day. I have two of them here that I wrote about, and her, when I met her nephew, and she had raised him. I mean, he had no idea. He'd never heard Library of Congress either. He had no idea that she'd ever recorded. It boggled his mind. It made no sense. His racial experience growing up in Mississippi in the mid-1950s was such that it was actually uncomfortable at first. He said to me, why would anybody care about a little black girl from Mississippi? And I happened to have with me that day, it's not like I'm an employee at Library of Congress, but I had with me, I don't know why I had it with me, I can't remember now, but I had the Canons of Selection, and these had been written by Archibald MacLeish just 3 weeks after Oradell made her recordings in 1940 at her segregated school there in Drew, Mississippi. And in it said, the library shall possess the records of the life and achievements of the American people. And I said to him, well, look, this nephew of Oradell's, I said, well, that means, and here she is, she was put out on this record in 1942, and here's the record, and I'm writing about it now, and I said, that means that the poetry of a schoolyard child is as valuable as the papers of a president. And here's palpable proof of it, because here's this record. And he said, oh, I get it. Okay. And we were driving around trying to find a place to copy the one photograph in the whole world of Oradell. Because when Oradell died, there were no death records by the state. There was no Social Security. There was nothing. I mean, she was buried in a grave. They put a little, in a segregated cemetery with just a little badge over it. That long had disappeared, long gone. And she died very young in a car wreck, on her way to sing in a tavern in Clarksdale. Her sister had been killed in a perpetrating a burglary, shot in the back of the head with her own gun. Her brother was killed after being serving time in Parchman. It was a rough family. It was a rough time. And this man's mother had just left home. And Oradell, he loved her so much, he called her name was Honey. That's a name at home, was for Honey. And she died at age 24, and she had raised him along with her grandmother. And that's what was in the home there. And so we went around, and eventually he just said, well, you know, we couldn't find a good enough place to copy that picture. He said, oh, I'll just take it home. And so I did take it back to Washington, made him a good copy of it. And when this book came out, he told me he was well pleased, and that made a lot of difference to me.
I'm sure. Mike, this is going to be track 4, which is the one we thought we might start out with. And it's Oradell Graham, recorded in Drew, Mississippi, October 24th of 1940. So she was about... How old?
She was 12.
She was 12 when this was made.
Yeah, I found her age through looking through the records of the Sunflower County School Board, and they had a census of the children, and that's how I was able to determine the right age.
And how did somebody decide that she's the one that they wanted to have record doing?
Well, her school teacher, she had a school teacher named Earlene Hughes, and she led her kids in song, and a group of kids were assembled. John A. Lomax, you mentioned before, had come by. He actually hadn't planned on recording there, but he tried making some more records. He had recorded at Parchman Prison in the past, and this time that warden at that particular time in October 1940 wasn't letting him in, and he drove past the Drew School, and there he had come there at the invitation of another family that lived there, a white family that did some interesting music, and one thing led to another, and a little boy in that family had actually sung one of the songs Oradell did, and he heard about the students there, I guess, and went over there and said he wanted some of their native songs, is what he had asked for, his words. And you know what might be more interesting and in point to our conversation is to go to track 3 and say, because you'll hear John Lomax talking to her.
Well, I was just going to say, why don't we do 3 and 4? I mean, they're so short.
All right. All right, let's do that. And these are two of the songs that Oradell let her classmates in. And then you'll hear she and John Lomax talking, and her self-possession here is great. And he'll ask her, where'd you learn it? She said, learn it. I just learned it just by going on singing it, which is a perfect enunciation of how it is to absorb this music. I just learned it just by going on singing it.
Oradell Graham and the two songs. Well, you'll figure it out.
I went downtown to get my grip. I come back home just to pull in the skip, just to pull in the skip. I went upstairs to make my bed. I made a mistake and I bumped my head, just to pull in the skip, just to pull in the skip. I went downstairs to milk my cow. I made a mistake and I milked that sow, just to pull in the skip, just to pull in the skip. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow never come. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow's in the bone.
And where did you learn that?
I just learned it by different one thing.
Where? Right here in Drew?
Yeah.
And say that last one over again. At Oh, now please don't laugh. Please. Say that.
Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow's in the bone. Tomorrow, tomorrow, tomorrow never come. And a hoo-hoo, and a hoo-hoo, and a hoo-hoo. I do love
shining green.
I do love
shining green.
Mama love
shining green.
Papa love
shining green.
Everybody love
shining green.
Two little babies laying in the bed. One play sick and one play dead. I do love
shining green.
I do love
shining green.
Ever since my dog been dead, hog been ruined my tater bed. I do love
shining green.
I do love
shining green.
Mama love
shining green.
Papa love, everybody love. Old lady Donna sick in the bed, sent for the doctor. Doctor said all she needs some shortening bread. I do love, I do love. Mama love, Papa love, everybody love.
That was a 12-year-old girl back in 1940 named Ordell Graham. Pulling the Skiff and Shortening Bread, a different version of Shortening Bread than the one I learned when I was back in the 60s.
Right. Well, hers is very bluesy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the one that was the hit and Andrew Sisters did and everything. Hers is different. Hers is more. That's the melody she's singing. Ever since my dog's been dead, Hawk's been written my day to bed, I do love. And it goes like that. And, they're down and sick in the bed. Sent for the doctor. Said all she'd need some shortening bread. I do love, Mama love, Papa love.
Yeah, a little bit.
You've got to answer shortening bread now, Kevin.
Shortening bread. Yeah, right.
Yeah, all right.
So a little of the blues, more of a minor key for one thing, or a blues mode.
Yep.
And also the bluesy rhythm and. A little bending of notes and so on. Stephen Wade is with us here on Live and Local today, live in our studio, as you can tell, with two different banjos. That was sort of the regular banjo, I guess.
That was my teacher's banjo. That was Fleming Brown's banjo right there. Yeah, that's made around 1909. And this is a much older kind here. This is a fretless banjo from Western North Carolina.
And this is just all made out of wood, looks like.
Yeah, like an axe handle with a little possum skin type head or raccoon skin. Or sometimes it had cat skin heads. And the man who made this banjo said that his uncle saw a cat walk by at their home and said, that's a banjo on four legs. And
a banjo waiting to happen.
Clucking Hen.
Clucking Hen.
Yeah.
But you're not going to make a banjo out of a hen, probably. Most likely. Where'd you get that one?
Western North Carolina.
Somebody it was pre-made, or they made it for you, or
no? He used to make them, and I have the last one he made. But that banjo there, that was made by a neighbor of Frank Proffitt's. His name was Clifford Glenn, who made that banjo. Frank Proffitt was the source of the song Tom Dooley. And Frank Proffitt's grandmother knew Tom Dooley and Laura Foster in a song. And in 1938, Frank Proffitt played that song for a collector from New York named Frank Warner. And Frank Warner then recorded in 1952. And then in 1958, that becomes a hit for the Kingston Trio. And this whole... there's enormous efflorescence of folk music at that point. Hundreds of thousands of guitars and banjos went into kids' hands. And really, that song, Tom Dooley, was a really pivotal moment in that transfer. And so Frank Proffitt played a genuine role in that. It came quite as a surprise to him, actually. And seeing that this local song, this family song, really, it's the first banjo song he'd ever learned. His father had taught it to him. They made him on homemade banjos, looked just like that. And then it was all around the world. It's on TV.
Stephen Wade is going to be given a banjo workshop tomorrow afternoon from 12 to 4 at the Community Center for the Arts in downtown Urbana on North Ray Street. If you weren't aware that they moved, they have moved. They used to be at the Independent Media Center building, and just still fairly recent. They're at the above and behind the Course in Music Studios at Race in Maine. And that's going to run from noon to 4. If you're interested in registering for the workshop, you can still do that. You want to get hold of Tom Faux, and his email address is TGFAUX. T as in Tom, G as in girl, F as in Frank, AUX@gmail.com, and I'm sure you'll get a reply from Tom about what you need to do and how to go about it. And then Stephen will be given a sort of a multimedia concert at the home of Danny Otto and Barbara Schenck, also in Urbana. And if you want to get involved in that, I'm pulling up the poster here, you want to call them at area 217-254-9876, and that's going to be starting at 4 o'clock on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And their home, well, they can give you the address once you give them a call. But they're advertising this as sort of sounds like a mini version of the sort of concert that you took around when your CD first came out, maybe, and when the book first came out.
Well, I've been varying whatever I've been doing about the book since then. As when I go into local communities, bringing the book back home, I tend to focus on the songs of that family. So when I was in Salem, Virginia, one of the chapters in my book is on the ballad singer Texas Gladden, and 36 members of her family came out. And what I did is I did a talk and a slideshow and played music relevant, related to Texas Gladden. And when I was in Hamilton, Ohio, I did the same, but with a different music for Pete Steele. But I've been also I have about 600 photographs. I won't show all 600, but I'll show a couple of 150 or 200. And talk about them with respect to the book, because it's just such a big story, and I'll have to stop before I want to stop is what's going to happen, because everybody's going to have to go home, but I'll just go, so I've been varying it. Last week I did a concert in Chicago last Saturday night at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and it was a 3-hour concert, and I had a friend of mine who plays guitar with me came in from Washington, and there I focused it on lessons really learned from my banjo teacher, Fleming Brown. There were sort of analogies to songs and moments in the book. So I've just handled it differently each time, and the spine of it has to do with that slideshow. I'm bringing these living people, putting them in front of everyone through the photographs and me talking and playing.
And the book we're talking about is called The Beautiful Music All Around Us, Field Recordings and the American Experience. Came out last September from University of Illinois Press. And we're hearing some things from the companion CD, where he's excerpted from his larger project called Treasury of Library of Congress Field Recordings on Rounder Records. Since you mentioned Texas Gladden, I'm guessing there's a good story about her. Well, of course there's good stories about all these people. That's why you put them in the book.
Well, Texas wasn't her nickname. Her name was Texas Gladden, and she had a sister named Tennessee and one named Virginia. She had a cousin named Tennessee, a sister named Kansas. That's it. Those were older names in the family. They were naming people in that family off the American map. And her younger brother who played music with her, Hobart Smith, Texas was born 1895 in Saltville, Virginia, and her brother was born 1897, Hobart McKinley Smith.
How did her brother get not named after a state?
Well, I'll tell you how he got his name. William McKinley was inaugurated president in January 1897, and Jared A. Hobart was vice president. Hobart McKinley Smith, born in May 1997.
One of those people, one of those names nobody would ever remember unless
people that time knew.
Yeah.
And so there were names, again, significant names on the American map. They're being celebrated by this family. And they were making it their own. And I think that's what she did with her music, this inherited body of music, that this common possession with her individual creativity brought to it. And just as Hobart did when he played the banjo or the fiddle or the guitar, he played everything. He told my teacher, Fleming Brown, in 1963, he could play everything except a car bumper or a barbed wire fence. And he really could, too.
And probably could use those for percussion if he wanted.
So he was terrific, yeah.
Mike, cue up track 10 on that CD there. And while you're doing that, I'll say that Live and Local today is made possible with support from Sweeney Brothers Carpet and Rug Gallery of Bloomington, a Nurison preferred dealer at 11 Westport Court on Bloomington's east side. Sweeney Brothers, where the beauty of a room starts with the floor. And it's time to donate your CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment to the vintage vinyl sale to benefit Illinois Radio Reader. You can take your donations of those items, use CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment to any BUC Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, Savoy, or Mahomet. Or you can take them to the sale site at 40 East University Avenue in Champaign. Call Dean Geiken for more information. His phone number is 217-333-6503. This is Texas Gladden from Salem, Virginia, in September 1941, and this is a little longer song. It's called One Morning in May.
When I was a young girl, I used to see pleasure. When I was a young girl, I used to drink ale out of right out of a barroom and down to my grave. Come, Papa, come, Mama, and sit you down by me. Come, sit you down by me and pity my care. My poor head is aching, my sad heart is breaking, my body's elevated, and I'm bound to die. Oh, send for the preacher to come and pray for me, and send for the doctor to heal up my wound. My poor head is aching, my sad heart is breaking, my body's elevated, and hell is my doom. I want three young ladies to bear up my coffin. I want four young ladies to carry me on, and each of them carry a bunch of wild roses to lay on my coffin as I pass along. One morning in May, I spied this young lady all wrapped in white linen, all wrapped in white linen and cold as
It's called One Morning in May, sung by Texas Gladden of Salem, Virginia, in September of 1941. And that's collected on a Treasury of Library of Congress field recordings, which was produced by Stephen Wade, and excerpted for this particular CD, which is a companion to the book that Stephen just published at University of Illinois Press last fall. It's called The Beautiful Music All Around Us.
Yeah, the CD's in the back of the book.
Yeah, and so is the list of what's on it, of course, which is pretty handy. But even more handy is to have Stephen here himself to be able to tell the sort of thing he's going to tell you, because he was just telling me while we were listening to that song, which is how you might have, why you might have recognized something
about
that
song.
Well, the
lyrics, that's the same family of lyrics of ideas that's in two of America's most well-known and popular and beloved ballads, which are The Streets of Laredo and the St. James Infirmary Blues. That funeral march that you hear in St. James Infirmary Blues, same thing that's going on here. Same funeral march that occurs in the cowboy song as well. Her version may connect to the oldest one. This is where the woman is dying of venereal disease. Now, when I spoke to Texas's family, including her daughter and son, who had heard her sing it to them as children, there was absolutely no, that was not an idea that was being, it was just an entirely melancholy song. It just set them sobbing, the sadness and beauty of the melody and the predicament in a sense of just the larger emotional predicament in song, not the specific circumstances that she's singing about the body salvated, which had to do with the treatment of salvarsan used before the development of penicillin and the treatment of venereal disease, and wrapping the body in flannel was part of the idea and the treatment that was used.
Very successfully, I assume.
Well, it was used until you got to, you know, there's mercury ointment is what it was, you know, they used until salvarsan, mercury ointment was rubbed. And that created this kind of some separation effects, and then eventually, you know, penicillin for the disease. But it for them, it wasn't a song about prostitution, which is what's going on here, and all of that. It was just a very powerful, emotional, sad song. And Texas had a large brood of kids, and singing songs to them at night was a good way to get everybody to sleep. And I was in the room where they recorded that song, and her son and daughter told me all about their memories in that room and the kinds of, and her daughter, who's named after Eleanor Roosevelt, again, this naming goes on. Texas was singing at the White Top Festival in 1933. Eleanor Roosevelt attended it. Texas met her then. She was pregnant with her last child. So Eleanor Wilma Jean came into this world.
You said in that some of the people in, or you didn't say this, but I read that some of the people on these recordings who you went and tried to find either them or their descendants or their relations of some kind, that some of them had, of course, this sort of tragic end that the little girl we heard earlier, but some of them went on to be to have some prominence in music, or at least to, you know, continue their music beyond this moment of recording?
Well, I'm trying to think of who that might be. I know that in the family of the Texan, of Jess Morris, I know that his grandnephew continues to be a real good fiddler. But I think I think what you're referring to is how these songs went on and these performances went on to have a larger life. I don't think so much family members were continuing as performers or singers so much in the folks that I spoke with particularly. But some of these songs have had much larger impact. These specific performances did, and this enormous renewal. The fiddler Bill Stepp, it's a very famous example. That's the first song I write about in the book, and I subtitle that chapter, Bill Stepp, you know, Retreat Across America. This is a man born 1875 in a cave in Kentucky. His is recorded by Library of Congress in 1937. That recording is meticulously transcribed by composer Ruth Crawford Seeger for a book called Our Singing Country. The book comes out in November 1941. Aaron Copland, at this point, is soon after is hired to do the score for a new ballet by Agnes DeMille called Rodeo, and he uses this wonderfully meticulous scoring by Ruth Crawford Seeger for the hoedown in segment in Rodeo. So when you're hearing 40 concert violins and a xylophone playing in unison, really we're hearing Bill Stepp, and it's a pointed connection. So that, and then that tune, you know, is used for the Beef It's What's for Dinner commercial, and it's used, you know, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer has
the tune that you have on here.
Yes, it's yeah. It's Fiddler Bill. It's that fiddler. And so when I played the recording for his family, they'd all heard Grandpa. And there were 65 grandchildren at this particular family reunion where I was at, had all heard Grandpa, or they called him that, or Fiddler Bill, play Bonaparte's Retreat. And they'd all heard the Beef commercial or the Rodeo of some sort, but no one in the family had connected the two. And so the pride that filled the hall was just palpable, and it was so wonderful. And I was so happy to be an agent in all of that, to present that to them. And so that's a piece of music that has gone on to become a signature sound in America for Copland's music. Others of these songs have had a renewed popular life. Ordell Graham's Pullin' a Skiff that we heard earlier, I mean, that it was from that recording that August Wilson drew, and there is a scene in Joe Turner's Come and Go the little girl Zonia Loomis is singing and does that song in the play. I mean, and then later I know that when Renee Zellweger did her part in that Civil War film in Cold Mountain, she listened to that recording, and part of the character she wins an Oscar with is actually built on what Ordell's saying there in terms of that self-possession that she has when she's saying about how she learned just by going and singing it, that strengthened her, that is so clear when she's talking to the recordist there, John Lomax. And so these things play unpredictable and remarkable roles in all sorts of tiny and large ways. I mean, certainly the Rock Online that I write about in the book goes on and on and on. It's had enormous impact. I mean, that's a song that got John, George, and Paul to start playing the guitar. And George
Rock Harrison, Online?
Yeah, George Harrison said so. I mean, that was a song that's the song that made him start playing, pick up the guitar. And the Beatles, before they were the Beatles, had a skiffle band. And the whole skiffle movement in England comes from the song that sparks the skiffle movement is Rock Online. Rock Online is documented in 1934 on a recording, and Lead Belly was the driver that day. He learns the song during the time that he picks it up in the Arkansas prisons where it's recording. Well, in this book and on that CD in the back of that book, that's the recording people he heard that then becomes recording. And then he transforms it, utterly transforms it from a quartet song, as they do it, into that marvelous whole work song, Cante Fabel, where he's talking and describing the train. That's different from what they did. He had brought his own creativity to it, but that was his source originally for the song, was these men singing. And then I got to know that family, the man who sang that song, led that song, of those two recordings and of Rock Online at recording the Arkansas Penitentiary in October 1934. But even more than that, I got to find the source before that. It was a song written by a railroad worker in Little Rock, Arkansas. He was an engine wiper, and he worked in the Biddle repair shops, and he wrote it with sang it with several of his co-workers and in a church in Little Rock, and in a moment that I'll never forget, ever forget, and I feel so lucky to have even had. I was looking through this particular Rock Islands magazine, and there it was with this report from the local, and this was a booster song. It was meant to promote the railroad urged its employees to write and make up songs and poems about the railroad, saying, well, more people ride the railroad, more secure your job is. And so this was one of many booster songs at the Rock Island Railroad. And there it was, all there in black and white. And some of the people named in the song in the original version were in the audience that night. It was said so in this. Well, I tried calling my editor here in Urbana at the University, or Champaign here at the University of Illinois, Judy McCullough. It took me 3 times to dial the phone. It was a touch tone phone. That was so, I knew what I was looking at was an unprecedented moment in my life. I'd never have this moment again. Mm. It was an extraordinary thing, because you never find origin in folk song. You find possession. Who's got it at the moment and what they've done to it? And that's often really, in some ways, more important. But here it was, the original Rock Online. Then by 4 years later, by the time it gets on this recording, it's simplified and improved, actually. Some of the details for the Rock Island Railroad are dropped away for the larger song that people can learn and remember.
Well, let's give it a listen. Mike, this is a track 2 on the CD that is found in the back of Stephen Wade's book, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, which came out from University of Illinois Press last fall, and sung here by Kelly Pace and a group out of, what was the name of the prison?
Cummins Prison Farm.
Cummins Prison in Gould, Arkansas, October of 1934.
I said, the Rock Island Line is the mighty good road. I said, the Rock Island Line is the road to ride. I said, the Rock Island Line is the mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you find. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Well, Jesus died to save me and all of my sin. Oh, while it's glory to God, we're gonna meet him again. I said, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. I said, the Rock Island Line is the road to ride. I said, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Well, the train left Memphis at 9:30. And well, it made it back to Little Rock at 8:49. I said, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. I said, the Rock Island Line is the road to ride. I said, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Well, Jesus died to save me and all of my sin. Oh, well, the glory to God, we're gonna meet him again. I said, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. I said, the Rock Island Line is the road to ride. I said, the Rock Island Line is a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you gotta ride it like you're fine. Buy your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Called
the Rock Island Line, sung by Kelly Pace and a group of prisoners, actually, fellow group prisoners in Gould, Arkansas, 1934. And Stephen Wade included that on his collection called Treasury of Library of Congress Field Recordings, and in turn used a smaller number of those in not exactly his life's work, but a pretty big chunk of his life for about 18 years, putting this book together, The Beautiful Music All Around Us, and going back to sort of document and get some of the background on the 13 songs that he does include in the CD at the back of this particular book published by University of Illinois Press. Stephen Wade is with us live here on Live and Local for all of 4 more minutes yet or so, and he's going to do a banjo workshop, pretty extensive one, for 4 hours from 12 to 4 tomorrow afternoon in Urbana at the studios of the Community Center for the Arts. At Race and Main Street. And then on Sunday afternoon, he's going to be at the home of Danny Otto and Barbara Schenck, also in Urbana, giving a sort of a multimedia concert. He'll tell some stories. He'll show some pictures that he's collected over the years and, of course, do some banjo playing. And then actually, a local favorite, Jordan Kay, will join him for a picking session later on. And he'll also sign copies of the book. So if you're interested in buying one, I'm sure he'd be happy if you decided to do that. Stephen has picked up his banjo here again.
My book started really, as I mentioned before, when I was a kid, when my teacher had urged me to go and listen to these recordings. at the Chicago Public Library and learn about music. He said, learn from the people who know how to play it. And so these are recordings of people. This inspired him to do the same, to go and learn from people. So I'll try to put together here both some people I knew that I learned from, and one of whom appears in the book and one of whom appears on my album on Banjo, Diary Lessons from Tradition. So here's the Spanish Fandango from Pete Steele. And from that, I'll go into a variation of Spanish Fandango, a thing called Snowdrop that I learned from Kirk McGee, who had been on the Grand Ole Opry for 56 years.
Folk musician, writer, researcher Stephen Way live in our studio, playing the banjo, obviously, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. You can get involved in his banjo workshop tomorrow by emailing Tom Foe at tgfaux@gmail.com. And if you want to hear his concert on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, you can phone 217-254-9876 and get involved in that. And Stephen, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
Our broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-244-9309. You're listening to 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music, and more for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 5 o'clock.